in your name. Amen. All right. So this is a class on world religions, and if you need to get up and go to another class, now's your opportunity. Just make sure that everybody knew where they were. I thought I'd start off by telling you a little bit about my goals for this class. I know this as a elective class has been taught before. Steve Hines has taught it before, and I just thought I'd throw my goals out there so that you can kind of know where I'm coming at with this. My first goal, overarching goal, is to conduct a practical, useful-to-you study of world religions that informs you of the beliefs of world religions. That one's probably obvious. That's probably what you expected. But if I stop there and all I do is give you a bunch of information, it's probably not worth a lot to you. I've taken a couple classes on world religions. They used to offer a world religion class at West Perry. And if you don't ever actually put that information to good use, it's not worth anything. So the rest of my goals are to help you put this information to good use. I want to be able to equip you to defend the distinctiveness of Christianity. And that's not a popular thing. If you were to take a world religion class in any secular university or even West Perry, because they did bring back their world cultures class is what they call it, you will not be presented with a version of world religions that says any one religion is right or that any one religion is better, more successful in any way than the others. And that's not the way I'm coming at this. I'm coming at this, and I just want everybody to know off the bat that I'm coming at this, that Christianity is distinctive, it's different, and there are things about it that you should know measured up against all the other world religions. So I want you to be able to walk away from this class with a deepened faith, that you understand why you believe Christianity as opposed to any other options that are out there. And I want you to be bolstered in your faith to that extent. And I want you to be able to explain that to other people as you leave this class. I also want to practice praying for missionaries, the unsaved and the unreached. I think oftentimes we can come at a study of world religions from the perspective that they're the enemy, that there's all these competing views out there, and the people who hold those views are our enemy. And I don't want you to have that viewpoint as well. I want you to understand that those are people that are caught in a worldview that kind of traps them and doesn't give them a whole lot of hope. And they're the people that we should be praying for, and we should be praying for missionaries that can go and reach those people. We should be praying for ourselves as missionaries as we talk to our coworkers and the people that we come up against every day, that we're able to defend the distinctiveness of Christianity, explain what we believe as we talk to our coworkers or whoever it is that maybe believes something different than us. And finally, I want to encourage you to consider how to evangelize people with different beliefs. So all of those kind of tie together, but I think they all kind of point back to that first one. You need the information first, but then the rest of them, I want you to be able to use that information. I don't want this to just be information that gets filed away in your brain and never gets used again. So to that extent, I have a little survey that I made up, and this is just to help me as we move forward with the class be able to know what information you would like from me. So as this comes around, I probably should have passed that out before I went through the goals. That way it would have all been distributed. Live and learn, I guess. The first question on this survey, they're real simple questions, but it's just, what alternative religious beliefs are you most likely to run into during the course of your daily activities? And I listed the main ones that we're going to hit as we go through this course. But because this runs for an entire quarter, that gives us about 11 Sundays, and you can see there's only about 5 listed there. So we're going to have a little bit of extra time, which means if there's anything else that you would like to know more information about, I would like to know that so I can prepare that and give that to you. If you have a coworker who is is Jewish or is Muslim or is Hindu or Buddhist or whatever it is, I want to be able to answer your questions and help you to be able to have a meaningful conversation with them. If you have, you know, if your kids are talking about someone at school who practices Wicca and you don't understand, you know, what is that? What does that mean? How do I help my kids? Because it's like two times removed. I don't know the questions that they're asking them at school. Then I want to be able to give you more information about that. If it's just a worldview, if you're wondering what is postmodernism, you've heard that thrown around and you don't know what it means, I want to be able to give you more information about that. So whatever it is, whatever world beliefs that are out there that you would like more information about, because I see all of these things as tied together, all of these competing worldviews, all these competing philosophies, whether they're religions or cults or worldviews, whatever you want to call them, I think they're tied together in our efforts as Christians of trying to talk to people and communicate with them clearly. So that's what the first question means. The second question then says, where are you most likely to talk to someone with a different belief system? That's just kind of for curiosity's sake. Is it at work? Are you limited in what you can say at work? Do you run into someone typically through the course of your day that's maybe a friend or an acquaintance? Or is this a family member that you might have an opportunity to have a deeper conversation with? So I kind of like to know those sorts of things just so I can kind of tailor that information even further. And then the last one then, just kind of a catch-all, what would you most like to learn about during this course? What questions would you like to have answered? And if you would like to take this with you and return it to me next week, you can do that. Or if you're like me and you think you would probably lose it if you took it away from here, then you can fill it out and give it to me before the end of the class today. That's up to you. But if you would like to take that home and think about it a little bit and just wonder, especially that last one, what might you like to know more information about, that's fine with me, and fill that out and bring it back next week. Okay, so I want to start off with an introduction to the way religion is usually taught. And we're going to look at two ways that religion is usually taught. If you were at a secular university or at a public high school, the way it would be taught. And we're going to look at the problems with those views. And then finally, we're going to look at the way that we're going to address it from this class. So the first one is a secular perspective that assumes that evolution is correct. And so if you were taking a comparative world religion class at a college, this is probably the way they would come at world religions in a sort of looking down on religious beliefs sort of way. They would assume that man has evolved, and so has his understanding of the world around him. That as man has evolved physically, so has his way of comprehending what is around him. And a secular perspective that assumes evolution would look at world religions in this kind of flow. They would start with, this is their claim anyway, they would claim that the oldest world religions are forms of animism, which is basically a fear-based religion where everything startles you. Okay, so we're timid little creatures and we are startled by thunder and we think there's spirits in the thunder and all those sorts of things. That's where they would start. And then a tiny step forward would be animism, which is where everything has a spirit. Animals have a spirit, trees have a spirit, the world has a spirit, all of this stuff has spirits and they can all be worshipped. And then next step down the line would be polytheism, which is a belief that there are many gods that can be worshipped. Then next would be henotheism, which is a belief that there are many gods that can be worshipped, but that there is one supreme God that should be worshipped over all. This is kind of like the Greek format with the pantheon of gods, which with Zeus at the top, I think, or is that the Roman name for him? I'm not sure. Greek, Zeus is the Greek name for Jupiter, is the Roman one, right? Yeah, but same deities or fake deities. So that's henotheism. And then from there, the evolutionist would say that the next step is towards monotheism, where you get rid of all the lesser deities and there's only one deity left. And then the final step, liberating humanity from this fear-based religion is atheism, where you give up all belief in anything supernatural that can't be explained because it's all just connected to fear anyway. That's what you would get at a secular university, this progression. Now, there are lots of problems with this. Does anybody want to shout out any problems that they see with making these assumptions or this worldview? They were concurrent. Yes, so some of these in this chain, animatism, animism, polytheism, henotheism, monotheism, you can still find some examples of these things today. So you can find tribes around the world that practice forms of animism or henotheism, and that's coexistent with monotheism. So it's not a simple chain of events like this. You can find multiple examples today. And I'll tag on to that again in a second. So exactly. So in our own country today, you can see a regression that's actually happened. I guess it doesn't show up when I point at a black screen with my laser pointer. But yeah, from monotheism backwards to animism or some of these other pagan beliefs that are getting resurrected and brought up and dragged into cultural discussion. Yeah, there's a real arrogance there, assuming that they're right. And so what assumptions is this perspective making? They're assuming that they're right. They're assuming all religions are fear-based, that there's nothing higher than fear that's motivating anyone who worships anything. They're assuming that evolution is correct, okay, aside from the fact that you can't design an experiment to prove evolution because you can't go back the amount, the length of time that they claim. So there's a lot of assumptions there that they have to make before you can buy into this. You have to assume that if physical evolution is correct, then the mind has evolved in the same sort of way. And there's a huge leap there from simply saying that physical organisms, that their mind had to have evolved in a similar way that their body did. So there's a huge leap there. Even if you swallow the pill that evolution is correct, can you make the jump that their mind evolved in the same sort of way? So I listed some of these, but you guys hit them all. It presupposes naturalism, which we talked about that. It presupposes a world that can be measured and that there's nothing supernatural going on ever. Okay, so it automatically rules out the supernatural. And you might wonder then, why would you study religion with this assumption in the first place? Why would you even start studying an area of beliefs that looks at the supernatural with the assumption that there is no supernatural? The reason is just because they want to, like Steve said, they want to assert their arrogance that they have found this correct position in atheism. There's the assumption that physical evolution is connected to human ideas, and as was also brought up, you can find lots of examples that contradict this flow of development of beliefs. About the only place you can see a nice, clean chain of events like this is in a textbook that is teaching religion from a secular perspective. That's the only place you're going to find animatism leading to animism, leading to polytheism, leading to henotheism, leading to monotheism. That chain of events doesn't happen in the real world. If you look at the way beliefs have really developed, they didn't develop that way. And we'll come back to that when we look at the chain of events that we're going to study world religions through. So the historical record doesn't show this to be true, and there are a lot of assumptions that you have to make for this to be your way of looking at world religions. Another way that world religions might be presented in a secular environment, and this one would maybe be more if you're taking, the last one would have been if you're studying world religions in like an anthropology course. This one would be if you're studying world religions more in a philosophy course. Is a relativistic perspective, and I'm sure you've heard, you guys know what relativism is because we're swimming in it every day, but the best example of relativism, at least as applied to world religions, is the elephant analogy. Has anyone ever heard the elephant analogy before? Okay, it's a Hindu Buddhist story. The lesson is that there's six blind men, and they're all trying to find out what this thing is, and they're all stumbling in the dark trying to figure out what something is. This something is supposed to be the analogy to truth. And they stumble onto this elephant, and the one blind man grabs the elephant's tail and is feeling it, and they think that truth is like a rope, okay? And then another blind man feels the elephant's leg, and they think truth must be like a tree, because this is like a tree trunk. And another person feels the elephant's ear, and they think, oh, it must be like leather. Maybe this is a page in a book. And another blind man grabs the elephant's trunk and says, oh, truth must be like a hose, okay, so that we can pump truth to wherever we're going, whatever. So the analogy starts to break down if you go too far with this. But all these blind men are trying to figure out what truth is by feeling their way in the dark and trying to figure out what this elephant is. And so they use this analogy to say, everybody who's searching is on the right path. Everyone will find truth because they all found the elephant. But I believe there are problems with this analogy. I'll ask you again, what are some of the problems that you see with using this explanation to say that all religions are really the same? Yeah, so you have to play pretty fast and loose with the actual beliefs of world religions if you want to try to kind of, if I can say this, dumb it down to a level where they're all equal. You basically have to take all the meaning out of any world religion to be able to put an equal sign between it and every other world religion. Any other problems that you see with this? Okay, well, the biggest one is that this is claiming that all truth is the same, right? So this is claiming, that all people's truth is equal. And if we believe that, then like X equals 1, 2, and 3 at the same time. Everybody's belief equals the same thing. If we put that, you know, on paper, you would recognize right away that that's simply not true. And that's kind of what John was alluding to. And that all world religions have distinctive beliefs. They have differences. And in order to say they're all the same, you really have to dumb them down to quite an extent. You have to neglect what they're really saying. The flip side of this, then, would be perhaps what they're really saying, the relativist, is that nothing is true. Okay? Either they're saying all truths are equal, or they're saying nothing is really true. And then you'd have to ask the question, well, is that statement really true then? Is this way of looking at religion, is relativism a true way of looking at religion? Because if you're saying nothing is true, then your own belief claims have to be submitted to that. You have to question yourself and say, well, then is what I think true? Is relativism true? If I've just said nothing is true, then relativism isn't true either. And you can throw it out the window. So essentially, this viewpoint at studying religion is logically inconsistent. It doesn't really make sense. So why does it keep getting perpetuated? I think because it makes people feel good that they don't have to make any judgments and they don't have to say one group is right and other groups are wrong. They don't ever have to make that judgment call. And so it feels good. They're going to cling to it. But at the end of the day, if what we're worried about is really people's souls, I think we can't just do what feels good. We have to kind of do the hard work of actually examining truth. So the relativistic perspective doesn't really hold up either. So the problem, it feels good, but it's inherently inconsistent or condescending, because the other option then is that the person who presents relativism is really saying, I see the whole elephant, but all the other world religions, they're only seeing part of it. And so I'm the only one with the true knowledge of what religion is like. So that's kind of a condescending argument. It oversimplifies the differences, which we talked about, and John 14:6, which I guess I don't have to look up. Jesus kind of blows this out of the water. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So if you believe the Bible holds any water, then that washes this one away, because there's no way of reconciling John 14:6 with a relativistic look at religion. So if you were to study, or if you would take a world religion class in any secular university, one of these two, or maybe a mixture of both, would be the perspective that that class would probably study this from. Okay. So I guess I'll pause right here before we go on to our perspective, hopefully our perspective, and just ask, is there any questions so far? Okay. So the last perspective, and the perspective we're going to look at religions from, is a biblical perspective that assumes that the triune God of the Bible is personal and wants to be known by his creation, and therefore has given us special revelation through the Bible, and that that's the way that we can know that our faith is true, and that we can hold all other religions up to that lens or up to that system, that framework for comparison. And if we look at the way religion develops in the Bible, and this is kind of going back to give you something to compare against the secular perspective, the evolutionary perspective that we saw at the beginning. The Bible shows pure monotheism first, because that was Adam and Eve in the garden relating to God in the relationship that they were supposed to be relating to God in, worshiping him as the only God that they knew. So that was pure monotheism. And then, of course, the fall happens, and then there's the flood with Noah, and Noah's remnant is a restored version of monotheism. Okay, and then Noah's descendants begin to repopulate the earth, and what we see is other versions, other maybe twisted forms of worshiping God, and then slowly a division of cultures begins to happen, and we see that division in the story of the Tower of Babel, where God struck the people that were trying to build this tower and separated them into different cultures, so basically creating lots of different cultures, lots of different languages. And from there on, each of those language groups kind of develops their own belief system until it degenerates into polytheism and idolatry. So this is what we see presented in the Bible as the natural course of religious beliefs when left to themselves. And I would say that this stands up to any other system that you would look at, in that when you create something, it's only as good as when you build it for the first couple of seconds after you build it. Then it starts falling apart, right? Anything you make starts to fall apart. I think that's the second law of thermodynamics. And that's a great thing to throw out there for anyone who believes in evolution, is how did this system, how can you believe a system gets better? Okay, because no other systems that you can look at get better with time. They all fall apart over time. And that's essentially what this view of world religions is saying, that it's falling apart. As people have drifted, they've grown farther and farther away from a true knowledge of God. Okay? Now, what's the problem with this belief? We'll see if we have anyone brave enough to criticize it. Yeah, so any system, whether it's like this building is a system, okay? As soon as it's built, it starts falling apart. There's a crack in the wall back there that I don't know when it happened. And the heat doesn't always, or the heat and the air conditioning. Like, we know the problems there, but it is a new building. And so it's slowly grinding down. Sorry, Dave. But it's slowly falling apart, and that'll happen anywhere. You build a brick wall, eventually, you know, it's going to start crumbling, and the mortar's going to get weak, and it's going to start to fall apart. Entropy would be a fancy word for it. Or the second law of thermodynamics says that things tend towards a state of decay. They all decay. Okay. So the evolutionist says that doesn't happen when it comes to life, because life is going towards a less chaotic, a more organized system. Yeah. Thank you. So a more organized system. Does that make sense? That they're claiming that the little changes in cells that we would think of as mutations, which if you actually look at them, normally are bad things. They cause disease and cancer and all sorts of problems. They're saying that those things actually create improvements that lead to new forms of life. Okay. I don't know if that answered your question or not. Okay. So is there any problem with this? Starting out with this worldview for studying religion? All the other ones that we looked at start with an assumption that they're right. Are we doing a similar thing? Yeah. Okay. So starting from more of a philosophical perspective and just arguing, does God exist? And I'm going to give you an article here in a couple of minutes from Ravi Zacharias, and he kind of takes a similar perspective on that. So one of the distinctivenesses of part of the distinctiveness of Christianity is that we, and you've heard this all the time, that we are offered a relationship with God. And sometimes that gets reduced to the point of it's relationship instead of religion. But it, as Doran has said, it's both. It is a relationship that has a prescribed way of conducting ourselves in relationship to God. And that's where the religion part comes in. So the Christian distinctive, at least in part, is that there's a relationship being offered. Okay, well, the problem that I see, and I don't really consider this a problem, is that we are making a presupposition, just like the evolutionist is supposing that evolution is true and the relativist is supposing that nothing is true. We're supposing that the Bible is true. We're supposing that the Bible is God's revelation, that the God in the Bible is the God that really exists, and we're supposing that God is trustworthy, that the Bible isn't a bunch of lies that he's trying to tell us to get us on the wrong track. And we make that presupposition, but I don't think putting your trust in this book is without reason. So if you have a chance, I always point to Nate Schaefer's study. He has taught a Sunday school series on whether or not we can trust the English Bible or how we got the English Bible. I'm not sure exactly what the title is that he puts on it, but it's a really good defense of how accurate the Word of God really is and how it has been passed down through history. And when we look at it, there's very little error that creeps into it. I think it's 99.9% the same as the earliest manuscripts that can be found. So that in itself to me is astounding and almost evidence in and of itself, as much evidence as you can say that there is a supernatural being guiding this book. But there are lots of reasons, and we could take a whole class about why you could trust the Bible, and there are classes offered like that. But simply saying that, I'm putting this out there because I want you to realize that everybody who studies religion, all your coworkers, all your friends, all your family, everyone that you talk to about religion is going to have presuppositions that they start with. They're going to have beliefs that they hold that hopefully they've thought about why they hold them. Hopefully they've considered, why do I believe this to be true? Maybe they haven't, though. And so maybe part of what you can do by having a conversation with them is just kind of ask some tough questions about what they believe. And the flip side of that is, if you're going to poke at someone else's beliefs, you should probably know what you believe pretty well, so that if they ask you questions back, that you can explain what you believe as well. So starting out, this has to be our foundation, that the Word of God is true and that the God that is shown in the Bible is true. Otherwise, we're not really, we might claim to be Christians, but we're not building our Christianity, I use that word loosely there, on the Bible, which is the historical document that Christianity is supposed to be built on. Okay. Ray Siervo, if you were here at the Apologetics Conference, defined worldview. And I've been using the word worldview, and we've been talking about worldview since the start of this class. But just real quickly as a review of what he said, your worldview is your personal way of seeing the world around you. It's how we make sense of the world that we see around us. It is shaped by our language. We think in terms of the language that we speak. So whatever language you learn shapes the way you think. It's also shaped by our culture, all the things that we see in the culture around us. Ray threw out movies, music, TV, and the internet as being the four main things that our American culture is kind of pushing on everyone. You can't get away from these things unless you turn off the electricity for a while. Your community also helps you to shape your worldview, and this can be good or bad. If you surround yourself with good things like a church, like a school that you can trust, like family members that you can have meaningful conversations with, that community can help reinforce your biblical worldview, but it can also tear it down if you surround yourself with elements in your community that aren't trustworthy. And our worldview is shown by our beliefs and our actions. And these are important that they're both, because your worldview isn't just what you believe, and then you can go out and do whatever you think, whatever you feel like, or whatever's easy. You can't just say you believe what the Bible says, but then go about your merry way and never stand up for the Bible's truth or try to defend what you believe. Because essentially what that's going to do is you're going to have to make a choice. At some point, that creates a disconnect in your beliefs where you're saying, well, I'm acting this way, but I'm saying I believe this. Do I really believe this? And humans have a tendency to go with what they're doing instead of what they say they believe, because it's always easier to change your beliefs than it is to change the way you've been acting. It's hard to reform your behavior, right? It's hard to break habits, and it's hard to act a different way around people. It's hard. It's just hard to start up conversations and meaningful conversations with people. I think people have a tendency to not even want to engage those topics. So it's hard to do those things. So it's always a temptation to just let those things slide and not let our worldview really play out in our actions. I think what I was just talking about is the importance of living out your faith and personal introspection. And Deuteronomy 6, I did want to read just a little bit of this, because it's essentially, it doesn't use the word worldview, but it's essentially talking about worldview and how we get it and how we pass it on. So if you have your Bibles with me, you can turn to Deuteronomy 6. We're starting to run down on time, so I'll try to be quick about this. Deuteronomy 6, we're just going to start at verse 1. And it says, "Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged." So you see there the idea that worldview is passed down through your family. At least that's one of the ways that these ideas can get passed down. So it goes from father to son to grandson, and those beliefs are just passed down. It says, "O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." And there again, that ties into the idea that you can't just say you believe these things that make up a Christian worldview. You can't just say you believe them and then not really let them change your actions, because it's with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Might especially points to action. You gotta live these things out. If not, you kind of have to question, well, then do I really believe them? So it says, "You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates." You might think it's a little extreme to bind God's word to your house and to your forehead and all those things, but at least having conversations with your kids or with your family as you sit in your house and as you walk in the way and before you lie down and rise up, you have to be talking with your kids about this worldview, about the Bible, or else they're not going to integrate the Bible into their worldview. Because all these other things like movies and music and TV and the internet that we can't really get away from, it seems, they're there and they're trying to get into our heads, our kids' heads, and I'm sure it'll just get worse in the future. But all of those things are competing for our kids' attention if we're not there trying to reteach or espouse a biblical worldview to them. How are they going to internalize that? How are they going to start making decisions that are shaped on the Bible? So anyway, I think Deuteronomy is telling us that this is our job, that knowing our worldview and passing our worldview on to other people, our kids, our family, our friends, our coworkers, it's part of our job. Yeah. Okay.
Like all those Thai people that Aaron works with, in their mind, to be Thai is to be Buddhist.
Okay.
Buddhist is to be Thai.
Yeah.
So an additional way that people's worldview is shaped is simply what nation they are a citizen of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or to be Russian is to be atheist because, I mean, or Chinese, you know, if that's the connection you make because they've lived for so long under communism that it's tried to wipe those things out. So part where it says family, church, school, nation could be in there as well in shaping what you're told you're supposed to believe as a good Thai citizen or Russian citizen or Chinese citizen. Yep. Okay, I said we were going to get to Ravi Zacharias, and so this is Ravi Zacharias' definition of worldview, and I threw in the stuff from Ray as a reminder. Hopefully you were at the Apologetic Conference and that stuck in your mind. But Ravi Zacharias says, a worldview basically offers answers to four necessary questions: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. In turn, these answers must be correspondingly true on particular questions, and as a whole, all answers put together must be coherent. Okay, so as we look at other world religions throughout the rest of this course, we're going to come back to these four questions. We're going to say, how does this religion answer the question of origin, where we come from? And I'm going to try to keep using this picture as a way of trying to make this relatable. Okay, so we got this person. This is a person. This could be you. This could be your coworkers. Could be friend, whatever. This person, in their mind, every day, they have to try to wrestle with these answers if they're honest with themselves. Where do I come from? Where does all this come from? What was the beginning? What is the first reality? Has all this stuff always existed, or is there something else that created this? Okay, so these questions, this is the first of the questions that Ravi Zacharias says a worldview has to try to answer. The second, then, is meaning. Does life have meaning? Is there a reason I'm here? Okay. So that's the second question, and that's probably a more personal question than the first one, origins. You could probably go quite a ways in life without really wondering about the question of origins, but the question of meaning, I think, hits everyone personally right in their heart because they want to know, do I have meaning? The next one is morality. Ravi Zacharias says, your worldview has to answer the question of morality, or how do I treat other people, okay? What is my standard for right and wrong? And is there something that tells me I'm supposed to behave a certain way instead of another way? How should I live my life? Is humanity inherently good, evil, neutral, or any other option that you can think of? Your worldview is going to answer those questions about how you're supposed to live your life. And finally, your worldview will give you an idea of destiny. Where are you going? What happens when I die? I would say the most personal of those two is probably meaning and morality. Those are the ones that people probably wrestle with the most, at least day to day. But origin and destiny is also very important to them if you are able to get a real meaningful conversation going with somebody. And all of this comes back to the idea that all religions, all worldviews have a foundation. And if we can find what that foundation is, we'll really understand in a meaningful way, in a way that we can actually have conversations with people, what their religion is all about. That's their foundation. Okay. So in this article by Ravi Zacharias, he talks about these four questions a little bit more. And as you know, I'm a public school teacher, so I assign homework. So I'd like you to read this article. It's only one page. And you can write all over it, and you can circle words if you're not sure what they mean. I want you to just think about this week and just try to figure out what Ravi Zacharias is trying to say about worldview. This should help you understand what he's starting with. And he does start out with an argument for God, and then specifically ends up with an argument for why Jesus is who he says he is. And next week we're going to take a look at the Christian worldview, and we're also going to talk about other competing worldviews today that shape other religions. For example, I threw out the word relativism there, that understanding what it means, what relativism means, will help you understand other religions, because Hinduism and Buddhism really don't teach that there is a truth, or at least Buddhism doesn't really teach that there is truth, okay? So you have to understand that they're coming from it, or coming at truth from a relativistic worldview. You might have heard the word postmodernism thrown around. So next week we're going to talk about what is postmodernism. And if you talk to an Islamic person in America today or a Hindu in America today, their worldview is definitely going to be shaped by postmodernism as much as it is shaped by their Hindu beliefs or by their Buddhist beliefs or Islamic beliefs, whatever it is. So you have to know those other worldviews as well. It's like layers of glass in front of their eyes as they're trying to look at the world around them, trying to see through all these layers to figure out what is going on around me. So we're going to try to answer some of those other questions about other worldviews next week. We'll start out with a discussion next week about this article. So if you have any questions, make sure you write them on the article, and hopefully we can get a good conversation going about that, and then we'll start to talk about other worldviews that people have. Give you a real quick preview of the class. After that, we will probably look at pseudo-Christianity or other Christian-ish worldviews or religions that claim to be just like Christianity. You've probably had a conversation with someone who said, well, essentially what I believe is the same thing you believe. We're not any different. And they just want to leave it at that, and they don't really want to talk about what any of those differences might be. How many people would say they've had a conversation? Yep, so like every hand in the room almost goes up. So we're going to take a look at that, and we're going to try to use this model to point out why their foundation is different than our foundation. That if they're not really building their belief on the Bible, then there's a world of difference between what they're saying and what you're saying. So we'll look at those first, and then we'll look at Judaism and Islam next. Those both being other world religions that have a book that we can look at and get answers from. And then finally, we'll look at Hinduism and Buddhism after that as being fairly different because they come from an Eastern worldview, and they're kind of different in the way that they look at things. So we'll try to cover those five major world religions there. And then after that, hopefully I'll get some feedback from your surveys. Anything else you're curious about, any other belief systems that you'd like to know about, we'll cover after that. And some of those might take more than 1 week to cover, but that's essentially my goal. Any thoughts or questions real quick?
The only thing I'm thinking about is look what's happening in our country now. Okay, with the police in the cities. And you know, they took the Bible out of schools, and what did the Bible at least do? It didn't force everybody to be a Christian. It taught origin, meaning, morality, destiny. Look at us today. Morality's not there. Mm-hmm. Mankind wants to make up their own morality. It's not Bible-based anymore. Our laws are not Bible-based anymore. They're wiping that, you know, take the Ten Commandments out without, you know, there was origin. Just you mm-hmm. can see what's happening to our country, let alone as we learn about the different religions. Yeah. They've created a society because look how many generations it's been. I wasn't here in this country when they took the Bible out, but I was here when they still did prayer and when they took the prayer out. So I was in high school. And, you know, of course, when you're a kid, you don't think about these kind of things. As you get older, adult, and you have children, and you see what's happening in the school system and stuff, and you see what's happening on a societal level and the conflicts that we see, and you just see they've taken, there was, you know, of course there was a game plan, but when you take that away, even from a nation, see what happens to the people.
Yeah, so if you're going to have a conversation with anyone today, you need to know that their answers for these questions
right.
may not exist anymore. That they, even if they are saying that they're a Hindu or a Muslim, they may not have answers to these questions. And that's really why I'm starting here, is because I want you to be able to ask questions about these things If you're talking with a coworker who says, I'm a Muslim, and you want to have a meaningful conversation with them, well, then these are some areas that you can ask these questions and really figure out, are they really a Muslim, or is their family Islamic and they're saying that they're coming from that background, but in reality they've been so shaped by the worldview that they live in, America, that nothing is right and you can do whatever you want and you can make whatever you want. And that would be very different from going to Iraq today and talking with a Muslim in Iraq and what they're... So hopefully we'll start to get equipped with this idea of worldview, and we'll be able to ask good questions of people as we're... Okay. Yeah. So ABC Family is not really for family anymore. It's yeah.
It's because there's no absolutes anymore. Anything goes. If you believe this way, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, there's no truth. There's no absolute truth. It's just like the elephant thing. Mm-hmm. You know, with the blind people. You know, this feels like a tree trunk. So that's what my truth is. It's a tree trunk.
Which is why we need to be able to. We need to be able to see that and say, it doesn't matter how complicated you're saying it is when you're talking to someone. And I talk to kids at school that are in this position all the time. No matter how complicated you want to think it is, what you're still claiming is that five people can have very different beliefs and still be saying all the same thing. And that just doesn't make sense. That can't make sense. You can't say five different things are the truth. Either there is no truth, or they're all wrong. That's just logic, and so we got to be able to tell our culture that.
And if you say there's absolute truth, like this is what's going to cause problems for us, because Jesus is the only way and the truth of life when it comes to salvation, then you're insensitive. You're intolerant. You're not tolerant enough, and that's this is what's happened in our society.
Yep. Any other thoughts out there before I'll just close in prayer? Yeah. Yeah, I think what you have to do is explain that you believe there is a heaven and a real heaven and a real hell that people go to based upon whether or not they had a relationship with Jesus when they were alive. And the least loving thing you could ever do is leave a person just go to hell without trying to stop that. So if your motivation is love and you can tell someone that that's what your motivation is, I don't know how they can say you're being a hater and you're insensitive, which they will. They'll still call you that. But but just being able to explain to them that the reason I'm saying this is because I love you and I don't want you to go to hell. Any other thoughts? Okay, I'll close in prayer because people are going to be streaming in here pretty soon. Dear Heavenly Father, I just thank you for this hour, and I just pray that something I said made sense to someone in this room, and I just pray that maybe through Ravi Zacharias' article that this week people would just continue to think about this issue of worldview. They'd continue to realize why this is important and why they need to know what their worldview is. Lord, I just pray that you would just be a grain of sand in their thoughts and just keep urging them to keep thinking about these issues as they go about this week. I pray that you give them good questions to come back with. And I pray that you would prepare our hearts for worship now as we go into the worship hour, that we would just be able to quiet all the other things in our minds, all the other problems that we have, all the other issues competing for attention with you, Lord, and that we'd just be able to focus on you. So I ask all this in your name. Amen. Thank you. If you want to give me your survey, if you're afraid you'll lose it, I'll take those. And if you want to take it with you and keep thinking about it, you are welcome to do that.